This is Inquiry. My special guest returning tonight is Roger F. Pasquet. He's a lifelong birder. He has been he's had careers with the International Bird Council, the Council for Bird Conservation, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the National Audubon Society. And we're continuing our discussion of his latest book, Birds in Winter: Surviving the Most Challenging Season. Now, Roger, last time we talked, we didn't get around to talking about the last two chapters of this book, which were the most important chapters. I hate to say this. So let's talk about the challenges of conservation of birds that move, especially the birds that migrate. This is a real complicated problem.
Yes, I'm glad to talk with you again, Mark. And indeed, it's complicated both for birds that stay in the same place all through the year as well as for birds that migrate. But let's talk first about the ones that do migrate, because obviously they have to deal with the situation on the ground in far more different places than the sedentary birds. And one of the interesting things to me in writing the chapter on conservation was thinking, what are the specific conservation challenges that birds face in winter as opposed to the rest of the year's seasons? And it struck me again often this fall when I've been seeing so many very tame kinglets, warblers, chickadees, that I realized I may be the first person that they have encountered, because in the northern forest, they're pretty much in people-less areas. So by the same token, the impacts of people on the land are something that many birds encounter in winter when they are farther south of their breeding range than at other times of year. And of course, the birds that have long migrations encounter changed environments or different environments all through the four seasons. So conservation is a complicated task, and one really needs to know every place that birds depend on over the course of the year and how they need to be managed, protected, or human intrusions dealt with to ensure that they have the time to feed and rest as they need.
One of the great things about your book is there's so much information jammed in there. There's always something sort of unexpected that I learned. And one of them is highly migratory birds of prey, mortality is most intensive during the migration. It's not where they breed. It's not where they go for the wintertime. It's en route.
Right. So these birds are traveling over places that are not familiar to them, and therefore they may find it harder to find prey and shelter as they are traveling than when they are in their familiar breeding areas or in the areas that they will spend the winter, where they are learning their way around. The interesting thing is that the survival rates during migration are lower than during the summer or the breeding season or the winter, but the breeding season and the winter, of course, are much longer than those transitory periods, and the survival rates over those periods pretty much even out. So survival over the course of the year is about the same, but each bird is at greater risk as it's traveling over unfamiliar areas.
You talk about the acronym HIPAA, which was originated by Edward O. Wilson, a conservation biologist and very, very famous. And he was talking about the major factors challenging preservation of diversity. And HIPPO is the acronym for habitat loss, invasive species, pollution, population growth, and over-harvest. I want to talk about them each in turn. Habitat loss, that still remains, other than global climate change. And that has to remain one of the greatest challenges to not just birds, but every single animal species on the planet.
Absolutely. And of course, habitat loss is closely tied to climate change, which is changing the nature and availability of different kinds of habitats. Let's start with the birds that do not migrate. They are perhaps at greatest risk of habitat loss, depending on their habitat, of course, because they don't move from one place to another. The birds that migrate have perhaps some flexibility in finding suitable habitat as they move around, while the sedentary birds, many of which don't even have the capacity to travel very far, do not. But yes, for all parts of the world, the rates of habitat loss and conversion from what birds and other wildlife need and to what people are using is a severe factor.
Well, you give the example of Bachman's warbler, now extinct. It bred in canebrakes in the winter habitat in Cuba and Isle of Pines, has been just totally decimated as far as the habitat goes. So that got it on both ends. It got it where it bred, because canebrakes have been, we've built stuff up on top of canebrakes, and it's got it where it wintered. It got it where the habitat there is has been totally ruined. And that seems to be true for an awful lot of neotropical migrants.
Well, that's true. And the Bachman's warbler is a good example of what is happening on a somewhat larger scale for many other birds. But the Bachman's warbler was particularly vulnerable because its entire wintering range was in parts of Cuba and the Isle of Pines, while its breeding range was from Arkansas and Missouri east to the Atlantic coast in South Carolina, a vastly greater area than the wintering range. But a lot of the birds that winter in Caribbean islands and in Mexico and Central America similarly have vast breeding ranges through from the Atlantic as far west as forests go, and the birds of the northern forest from the maritime provinces of Canada all the way west to the to Alaska. Just any look at a map will show you how tiny their wintering range is compared to the breeding range, so that these birds are packed in much more densely than in their breeding season. And so the loss of every acre in the wintering range has the equivalent impact of several acres that might be lost in the breeding range. So the Bachman's warbler is an extreme example of habitat range compression during the winter, but the other warblers that winter in the Caribbean generally or in Mexico and Central America are faced with the same challenge on a slightly less urgent scale.
It seems like, Roger, one of the real challenges here in trying to preserve habitat is it's not one political entity. You're dealing across borders with different countries which have different priorities, and it's not easy to get an international agreement as to what should be saved and what can be sort of sent over for development.
That's right. A lot of these birds are protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, but that doesn't really address habitat issues on the ground. It has more to do with shooting and other forms of direct persecution, if you will, of birds. So, yes, the challenge is creating a coordinated response and dealing with the different cultures and the different needs of peoples in those countries. But generally, we can say that better forms of agriculture, more sustainable forms of agriculture, are also beneficial to people as well as to birds. And with the great example in this hemisphere is the use of shade coffee create habitat for a lot of migrants and a lot of residents in the tropics. It's not perfect, but it's a lot better than a coffee that grows in the sun and has no protective layer of other trees that is the chosen habitat of a lot of migrants and a lot of resident birds. And now, of course, almost everywhere you can find shade-grown coffee for sale, and people should buy it just as they can now buy shade-grown chocolate and various other crops that are long-term benefits for the communities that are growing these crops as well as for the birds that share these communities with them.
Water birds, too, shorebirds, waterfowl, they're also endangered. It's not just birds that are living in tropical rainforests, but wetlands seem to be systematically altered everywhere here and where they're overwintering.
That's right. And you know, I was rereading that chapter yesterday and thinking about all the foods that we eat and being reminded from the book that soy, which everybody thinks is a better thing than eating meat and probably is, still you want to know where it was grown, because a lot of the former rice fields around the Gulf Coast that were wonderful habitats for water birds, shore birds, and waterfowl are now being converted to soybeans, just as grasslands are being converted to soybeans, so that there's no end to the number of ways that wetlands are seen as disposable. First, they were filled in, then the remaining ones were used as the sort of outflow for all the industrial and agricultural waste from higher grounds around them, such as we see around the Gulf of Mexico, where on the Texas coast, for example, even the wintering site protected specially for the whooping crane is surrounded at some distance by various kinds of industry that sends all kinds of runoff into the very waters that are protecting one of the most endangered birds of North America. So wetlands serve enormous value to communities as storm buffers and as the sources of the nursery areas of crabs, many fishes, and they have tremendous economic value that are recognized in some areas such as around the Chesapeake Bay and the other bays along the North Carolina coast, but perhaps less so on the Gulf Coast, where, of course, a lot of them around the Mississippi are subsiding into the sea because of the channelization of the Mississippi that prevents them from the sediments coming down the length of the Mississippi from recharging the sinking wetlands. So wetlands are extremely vulnerable, and of course, sliding into our other topic, climate change, are increasingly vulnerable coastal wetlands as sea level rises and moves over them. Big challenges.
Well, and that dovetails into pollution. We were talking about organophosphates. Oil spills still occur, unfortunately, fairly regularly. But marine debris, especially microplastics, that was something that sort of came up in the last two decades. I don't remember as a kid a lot of people talking about marine debris as a problem, and that suddenly exploded.
Yes. Well, of course, there is far more plastic being used all over the world than ever before. And plastics, anybody who lives near a beach and goes to a beach will likely find plastics on the beach and will likely see gulls pulling at pieces of plastic and seeing if they're food and trying to eat them. And it's a global problem, and I have to cite my 7-year-old nephew in Australia very proudly for starting a campaign to remove plastics from the beaches near his house, and he's designed a T-shirt that people are wearing there
to
create awareness. He's 7 years old, he's a bird watcher, and he's already aware of the problem and raising money to promote taking plastic off the beach. The larger problem, of course, is reducing the use and manufacture of it in the first place. And, you know, everybody can ask himself or herself, do I really need this piece of plastic? And if I'm using this piece of plastic, can I be sure that how I dispose of it will never get into any natural environment? Either it can be recycled or it can be put into some sort of a landfill or someplace where it's just not going to reach in birds or other creatures in the sea that will mistake it for a jellyfish or for anything else that they will eat, swallow, and choke on.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest today, it's always a pleasure to talk to him, Roger F. Pasquier. He's a lifelong birder. He's had a career with organizations like the International Council for Bird Conservation, the Environmental Defense Fund, the National Audubon Society. He's currently an associate in the Department of Ornithology at the American Museum of Natural History. And we're talking about his latest book. And it's one of those things that the book has so much stuff in it. You really need to sit there and sort of get into it. We're talking about birds in winter, surviving the most challenging season. Roger, to me, almost all of these issues that we've been talking about is a subset of population that and nobody wants to talk about that issue. We really have almost too many people. People means you're going to generate destruction of habitat. You're going to have pollution. You're going to have all sorts of other stuff, over harvesting. But it all seems to center on population.
Well, yes, to a certain degree. There's certainly too many people in some parts of the world that are consuming too many resources that could be used more sustainably. Much of the issue of population and the environment really is a balance between absolute numbers and consumption patterns. There are other places where the consumption of natural resources is vastly less than it is in the United States,
for example. Yeah.
But the overwhelming numbers of people are more than most places can sustain. I was reading just the other day that in Nigeria there are now more people than in all of Europe. And in Africa, the average, half the people in Africa are now 30 years or younger. So that means there's going to be a tremendous growth, further growth in African populations in an area that is subject to increasing droughts from climate change. So there's no question that most of the world is going towards a period when there are more people demanding more out of life and out of the Earth's resources than the Earth has ever previously generated, either in the way of crops, minerals, energy sources, or the increased use of leisure that many more people are now enjoying and deserve to enjoy.
You have a great example in your book. You talk about disturbance at winter recreation destinations in Monterey, California. There's a study. The shorebirds that are trying to overwinter there are dependent upon the beach to get their foods. And the sanderlings there were disturbed every 15 minutes.
Right. So as I was thinking about the conservation issues that are specific to winter, it did occur to me that there are more and more people who have the opportunity now to take vacations or get to places in winter than ever before, when people who had vacations in the first place usually took them in the summer, but now many people are able to take them in the winter as well. So the two places that are classic winter destinations are beaches in warmer parts of the world, and mountains where they can do winter sports like skiing. So those are two habitats that are very important to birds that have very specialized needs, and that were until quite recently in many parts of the world pretty much inaccessible, but now more and more beaches are accessible and used through the winter months, and more mountain sites at just the ranges that are ideal for certain kinds of grouse and other mountain birds are exactly the places where ski resorts want to be. So yes, around the world, the proliferation of leisure and leisure resorts is having an impact on birds that until recently were pretty secure.
Well, you know, even when we're trying to do something right, like for instance, the construction of wind turbines or solar farms, we can run into problems that I don't think people understand exist. For instance, around here, solar farms are really big. I'll suddenly turn around, and in a place where I used to get breeding whippoorwills and grasshopper sparrows, there's now a solar farm, and nothing's living there anymore. And you just sort of wonder, like, even our solutions don't seem to be that great.
Well, everything has its consequences. Solar farms, there are few places that you can put something that's flat over the ground that isn't going to cover something else that also has value for a different purpose. Wind turbines, those at least, there are better and worse places to site them, and the studies that are being done are showing that there are a lot of places where they have quite minimal impact on birds. So let's hope that wind can be a major source of energy, replacing some of the others that cause more damage. Solar things, that's a really tough thing for siting when you want to go beyond the scale of putting solar panels on roofs of actual buildings. So I don't have much of a solution except putting them on over parking lots and areas that they can be roof height without having any real impact on the reasons that the land underneath them is being used for a valuable purpose.
The elephant in the room around which we're talking, of course, is climate change, which just sort of seems to be this impending sort of behemoth that's just continually marching, and we're already starting, it seems like we're starting to experience the effects of. For birds, has there been a change in the winter range, a shift in the winter range for some birds that we already know about?
Yes. So climate change, you use the word impending, but much of what we are going to see is already taking place in different parts of the world. And yes, the winter ranges of birds are one of the easiest examples to show how things have changed so rapidly in just a few decades. Almost any place that a bird watcher lives, a bird watcher is likely to see different birds in the winter than a few decades or even 10 years ago. And not, in addition to seeing birds wintering farther north, you will see many birds that don't migrate very far coming north earlier in the spring than they used to, and probably staying longer in the fall than they used to. So the birds are a very efficient indicator of the rates of climate change. And the challenge for birds, of course, is that they cannot all adapt to climate change as rapidly as the land is changing. So many birds that may be arriving farther north earlier in the spring are still not arriving as early as the plant and animal food sources that they depend on in spring are reaching the stage that they are normally harvested at.
Now, there's also some evidence, some research, that time being spent on the winter range in some species is diminished?
That's right, because the birds that are, for the most part, short-distance migrants don't all feel the impetus to go south until it gets to a certain degree of coldness, and they may not go as far south as they did in the past. So, plus, they're leaving earlier from their wintering range because they're already getting the signals that conditions are getting milder at late winter, and they can take advantage of that. The big difference is between those birds, Mark, and the ones that go far from North America that are wintering in places where they have no clues whatsoever on what's happening at their breeding range, and that have evolved to time their migrations, both spring and fall, by the changes in day length. So they are staying on a much more traditional, if you will, schedule than the birds that can respond in Maryland to what is happening there and move north to Massachusetts in a couple of days.
There's so many aspects of global climate change that are going to affect everything, but one of them is increased desertification. The deserts are going to get larger. And I think about the European birds that migrate across the Sahara, and that's a dangerous thing to do, as it is anyway. If the deserts get any larger, I have to believe that's going to mean increased mortality.
That's right. So the length of the Saharan desert has changed over time, over the last several thousand years, expanding or contracting, and birds have evolved during that period that fly over it to make it across. But just like the birds that come across the Gulf of Mexico, as soon as they hit land, they usually plop down and are eager to rest and feed. So the birds coming across from North Africa, whether they've flown over the Mediterranean or just started in the northern coast of Africa and go over the Sahara down to the Sahel, they are often at the margins of just how far they can travel without exhaustion. So the years that conditions are better in the Sahel where these birds are wintering, the better the conditions are there, the better and more fit the birds are to make that long flight to the north than in years when conditions are poor when it's drier, when the deserts are expanding. And the deserts or the semi-desert that the Sahel is on the border of, that expands and contracts in sort of decadal cycles that are exacerbated by the human use of it, which can eliminate a lot of the vegetation that holds the moisture and provides the shelter for birds. So that's an old world problem that we don't have so much in this country, but desertification is simply the extreme example of reduction of rainfall in sort of low latitudes approaching the equator, which we already see in the Caribbean and is already found in parts of Amazonia as well. So the loss of habitats because rainfall is diminishing is a Western Hemisphere problem as well for wintering birds.
So can we foresee, as climate change increases, increasing extinction rates for certain species?
Yes. So unfortunately, extinction has been projected as a likelihood for many more birds due to climate change and the loss of habitat than any other factor previously affecting birds. The greatest rates of extinction will be in tropical areas where birds face two problems. The ones that live in areas of mountains such as New Guinea, parts of Africa, parts of Asia, the Andes of South America. Birds there, as well as in the Rockies and other mountains farther north, are all moving higher up the slopes as their habitats move up with them. But the birds at the very top have no place to go.
Jeez.
And those birds are diminishing, and as other birds move farther up the slopes, the area that they have available is diminishing also. So those birds are certainly going to decline, and some are likely to have no place to go at all.
Roger, we're going to have to end it there because we're completely out of time.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
There's
lots more to say.
There's a lot more, and a lot more in the book, and I should say that. My name is Mark Lynch. We welcome back tonight Roger F. Pasquet, lifelong birder. He's had a career with organizations like the International Council for Bird Conservation, the Environmental Defense Fund, and the National Audubon Society. He's currently an associate in the Department of Ornithology at the American Museum of Natural History. And his latest book is just an incredible sort of compendium of the latest scientific research. It's called Birds in Winter: Surviving the Most Challenging Season. Roger, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks, Mark. It's always fun to talk with you.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Lonnie Lynch. Good night.